Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone on Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. Winter Park-born Shannon Gilliam says she was 13 years old when her drug addiction began. She overdosed several times, but her life has been saved. Now she's on the road to recovery. Central Florida leaders are reporting historic drops in opioid overdose deaths. CDC data shows a decline in Orange, Osceola, and Seminole counties in 2024. In Seminole County, fentanyl-related deaths fell by 42% last year. While the trends are significant and even encouraging, this progress does not mean the crisis is over. Fentanyl-laced illegal drugs are still driving deaths. The potent synthetic can be fatal the first time it's used. Dealers are still mixing it into fake prescription pills and other narcotics. Close to 7,000 Floridians die each year from opioid overdose. Naloxone is saving lives. You may know it by the brand name Narcan. Central Florida-based Project Opioid distributed thousands of doses last year. When administered quickly as a nasal spray or injectable, it reverses the effects of opioids like heroin, fentanyl, or codeine, and restores breathing. Timothy McKinney is the CEO of United Global Outreach, a Bithlo-based nonprofit that focuses on transforming underprivileged and neglected communities in Central Florida. McKinney joined Engage to discuss what life-saving strategies are working and what more needs to be done here. First, you're going to hear from Shannon Gilliam, the Winter Park native in recovery. Shannon begins our conversation by sharing her story.
I am someone from homelessness, from addiction, and I started my addiction at the age of 13. It, you know, grew over time. I come from being sexually abused when I was young, things of that nature. I have been in and out of programs most of my life. First time I started was in 2004, was my first treatment. And along the road, I have gotten to know, you know, certain people that were more addicted than me. I also have had the experience of, you know, not just my life being saved by Narcan, but other people's lives. I have saved, honestly, probably about 20 or more. Myself, I have been saved 4 times total. This last relapse that I had back in September of last year was the first time that I had had an overdose and had to be brought back to life with Narcan. It was 3 times within a 36-hour period. So if it wasn't for the Narcan, I would not be sitting here right now.
So talk about that experience. When an overdose is happening, is there any awareness that this is going south?
You know, when I think about it, I just remember like having this feeling of something wasn't right. Very dizzy, foggy immediately. And next thing you know, I woke up on the ground with people standing around me and they said, "You've been Narcan'd." Also, you know, people don't think about this either. You know, when you're Narcan, you are not supposed to use right afterwards. That is something that I did, which put me right back into an overdose.
And when we say using, we're talking about?
Using fentanyl.
Okay.
Yes, using fentanyl. So for me, I really would not be sitting here right now if I would have not been saved by it.
Who administered it?
It was a friend of mine. I was just at their house hanging out. And I went into the bathroom and see, nobody knew that I was using. And I'm grateful that they thought about coming in there because if they wouldn't have, I wouldn't be here either.
Why did they have naloxone on hand?
We are all addicts that, you know, where I was hanging out, the circle that I was in. But honestly, lately you've been able to find that in a lot of places. They've been administering it, you know, sometimes going door to door.
Who are they?
Some people from like recovery. Like, not recovery connections just alone, but for, United Global Outreach, they have it on hand at all times. You can come to Transformation Village and you can get some. You can go to the fire department and get it. They used to have people that were going door to door a couple times a week. That happened for a few months, but then it just stopped. But for me, like I said, I think it's made a world of a difference of having it more on hand than it wasn't before. I've seen a lot of change in overdoses in the area that I live in, because living in East Orange County, there's a lot of addiction over there and a lot of homelessness.
Describe that change.
You know, instead of every day you're hearing two and three overdoses, you're really not hearing about them much anymore. Not saying that it's not out there and that it's not happening, but you're not hearing it on a daily basis like we were. Like every day, there was at a time where I think we had, I want to say it was like 19 overdoses within, I would say not even 2 months, I want to say. I mean, there was at one point where it was just nonstop. It was happening constantly. I think United Global Outreach bringing the recovery connections out into East Orange County has made a world of difference. Mental health, to me, that is a big thing for a lot of us that, you know, are living on the streets and are trying to overcome not just an addiction, but the mental part also.
Are you seeing those services readily available?
Yes, I'm seeing them more readily available than they were before. Like I said, United Global Outreach has made a very big change in not just my life, but a lot of people's lives. A lot of my friends I've seen, they have gotten clean. They are staying clean. The MAT program, Medicated Assistant Treatment, is a big change too. And that comes down to, you know, your methadone, your Suboxone, your Subutex. I never thought I could do that. I didn't think that was something that would be an option for me. But I think with me, it was more of how my family felt about it along the lines. But it has to do, you know, I have to do what's right for me. So I think medically assisted treatment has made a big world of difference also, along with the Narcan. And just having things readily, you know, to be there. Because living, like I said, living in East Orange County, it's very hard to get to places like that and to get the help that we needed. But now that United Global Outreach has been out there and they have successfully brought back a lot to the community than I've ever seen before, really.
We've seen Naloxone on the market for about, what, 12, 15 years now?
It's been out there for a while, but it hasn't been readily available for a while. You used to have a prescription to get it.
What was the point at which it went from a prescription to get it to something that was readily available, you know, first with first responders and then in the community?
Yeah, last year the legislature passed some incredible laws that allowed folks to get Naloxone without having to have a prescription. Before that, serving on the board of Project Opioid, we had to have a doctor write a prescription for us to be able to distribute it.
One of the things I've seen in other state legislatures when these have come up is concern from lawmakers that this emboldens users, that it reduces obstacles to usage. And insofar as lowering risk, is that something that you hear or see yourself?
No, I think that's a matter of ignorance. As Shannon and I were talking earlier on the way here to do this interview, when someone gives you Naloxone, you are instantly in withdrawal and you feel like crap. So nobody's going to do that on purpose, believe me.
So you yourself have administered Naloxone products to people in overdose distress. Talk about that. Talk about what you see that tips you off that this is a person experiencing an overdose, what the actual process of administering it is.
Yeah, it was quite incredible. And it actually wasn't directly related to our work in East Orange County or in Bithloe. I was riding with a guy that at the time was 75 days in recovery. And we were running some errands and going to some meetings and passed around the dollar store here at Goldenrod and Lake Underhill. And when we were passing the dumpster, he said to me, "Back up, I think I saw something," and literally saw the elbow sticking out of trash in the little alleyway. And a gentleman had just fallen face first into the mud. And so we were able to get in there, get him turned over. He was bluer than the sky and looked dead. And it literally took 4 doses of Kloxxado, which is twice the strength of Narcan, before he finally sat up and woke up. It was quite an incredible experience. He literally was dead and came back to life. That's the miracle of this drug.
And, you know, just a couple of years ago, this was a drug that was routinely being administered to people experiencing heroin overdoses We're talking about fentanyl in 2025.
Yeah, I mean, it works on any opioid, so that's the great thing about it. I mean, I have a school actually in Bithlo also. If a three-year-old grabbed a hold of it and squirted it up their nose, it wouldn't hurt them. It's only powerful to opioids, and heroin is a thing, and it's a bad thing, but fentanyl is an incredibly worse thing. It's 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, so it literally controls the user, and the user has to use every day, or they feel like they're dying, or literally they could die due to withdrawal.
Talk about the increase that you've seen of fentanyl usage in recent years. This sort of went from an abstract additive to the drug of the day, kind of.
To a poisoning of our country, literally. I mean, drug dealers are putting fentanyl in everything. So people that think they're only using UPS, methamphetamines, literally are testing positive in our medically assisted treatment center for fentanyl. And the reason for that is the dealers are lacing everything, including marijuana and sometimes even alcohol, with fentanyl, because then the user uses a whole lot more. And so we're even seeing psychosis in those that are using methamphetamine because they're using way more than they ever would have if they weren't physically addicted to the drug.
How does that change the way in which you're interacting with people who are both using and seeking rehabilitation treatment?
Well, I mean, it makes it life or death. I mean, literally every day we're doing street outreach, sending peers that have lived experience out into the woods, trying to find folks that are living, candidly, a subhuman existence here in America. They're living a life that's no human being should be living because they're controlled by this drug. And so when I talk to folks, I literally say, please stay alive until tomorrow, because there's no experimenting with drugs. There's no partying anymore. This drug is so controlling that one use could be the lethal dose that it takes, which is why we're literally recommending that every person in Central Florida through Project Opioid have naloxone in their car, because a lot of times people think, well, I don't use and I don't know a drug user. I don't need to carry this. No, no, you may pull into the grocery store parking lot and someone's literally overdosing in their car, and you might have the opportunity to bring them back to life so that we can then introduce them to a system of care that'll help them live.
What's the messaging from you at that level? I mean, you're dealing with people that have lowered their standards so much. You know, what's the pitch?
Well, the pitch is that you're a very important person. You don't have to live like this. But as Shannon alluded to, access to care in East Orange County was never available before. So geographically, if you wanted to get help, you couldn't get to help. And so the recently opened medically assisted treatment center, thanks to Clear Futures and Recovery Connections and Dr. Todd Husty and his team, have allowed us to bring care into the neighborhood so that we can build relationships, bring people to Transformation Village, which is open 7 days a week at our community coffee shop and library, and some other resources that are available to our unhoused friends, like showers and social work and licensed mental health counseling and access to clothing and laundry services. So instead of being miles from help, they're literally 100 feet from a clinic. So as we speak, literally folks are getting access to mental health care, seeing the psychiatrist, getting the medications that they need to be stabilized, because, you know, it's the old chicken or the egg. You know, is it the psychiatric issue that causes you to become addicted to drugs, or is it the addiction to drugs that causes the psychiatric issue? So we have to really literally have a holistic approach to treating the whole person and then helping them beyond the medically assisted treatment to getting into the residential sober living and recovery process so that they can start addressing the people, places, and things in their life that have caused them to stay in bondage.
Shannon, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I agree. You know, I think, like I said, it's made a world of difference to have the medical assisted treatment program out there with the mental health, because that's where I started to struggle. A lot was more in my mental health at the end, you know, than it was just my addiction. That's what took over me every time that I had a relapse or when I thought I just couldn't handle life on life's terms. Me having the type of generalized anxiety that I have, you know, sometimes I would have paranoia, things of that nature. So I didn't have the insurance or capability, you know, just to go to any type of a program and get help. So being able to go and talk to a therapist, I get to see a therapist once a week with Recovery Connections. I also get to see my mental health specialist twice a month. There's, you know, when you don't have insurance or ways of doing things, there's scholarships out there. There's grants out there that help you with your medication. But I think, yes, the MAP program has made a world of difference out there in East Orange County.
Shannon, what was the break point where you turned the corner, changed your life, decided to put addiction behind you?
I've been off and on of probation for quite some time. And I remember, which, you know, I knew I had a warrant for my arrest. I knew that I did. And really, honestly, that day, I just was ready to walk in there and be done. I was tired, just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Nowhere to go, no roof over my head, sleeping either in a shed, a tent, or by a bonfire, or sometimes not sleeping at all and just, you know, bouncing around from place to place. And once I really opened up and gave myself that opportunity, and really God showed me something while I was in jail, like, hey, this is your chance, this is your opportunity, and let's just go. You know, so last year I put myself in, you know, three different programs. Programs help, but you have to be wanting to do it yourself. You have to be ready for that. Because if you're not ready, you're not ready. So it has to be really on the person and if they're really ready to make a change and willing to make that change. Because I don't want to put my kids through that at all. I don't want them to get that phone call that I've passed away over something, you know, that I could have taken care of and handled and changed. Because it's just as much not fair to them as it's not fair to me.
Shannon, you said you started using around 13.
Mm-hmm.
If you could go back and talk to 13-year-old Shannon, what would you say to her?
Oh, I would tell her I wish that she would have taken the opportunity to go with the counseling. Take things that were offered to me, you know, because my mom tried. She did try to get me in counseling. She did try to get me help. But I was also raised in a home where there was nothing but drugs. So for me, growing up was a lot different than a lot of other people. You know, all I could do is try to tell her to just push through it. You know, I wish I would have made better choices, but I didn't. So really, you know, the kids nowadays, they're just not understanding how serious this stuff is. Because that's another thing, you know, like Tim had mentioned, they're putting the fentanyl on everything. We have kids overdosing on marijuana, you know. So for the kids out there today, you know, all I can say is just say no. You know, I can't take my time back. But I do have to say, standing here today is a thankfulness to the Narcan. I do have to say that.
Shannon, thank you so much for sharing your story
welcome.
With us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I know it's not easy to do on a Monday morning.
It's okay.
Tim, is there anything you'd like to add, anything I didn't cover?
Well, I think now that we have access to care available in East Orange County and in Bithlow, the next stage is for us to take these violent drug dealers off the street. They're literally exploiting and really keeping a population in slavery. I'm becoming aware now as we've gotten so many people into treatment and they're 6-7 months in recovery and their mind is cleared up and they're telling me stories of being pistol whipped and beaten and zip tied to chairs and even shot in some cases, and they're unwilling to call law enforcement and prosecute and literally buy the drugs from the drug dealer that did those bad things to them because they're so controlled by the drug. And so the next phase is restoring safety and security to East Orange County. And so we've started a process where we literally have been identifying and targeting these violent felons and really set a standard that if you're willing to deal a drug that could kill someone, and if you're willing to exert violence on people, you've got to go. And so we've successfully taken down three drug dealers in the past 3 months that literally have been terrorizing this community for decades. And I've got quite a list ahead, and I'm working with law enforcement, the sheriff's office, the U.S. Marshals, the FBI, DEA, Seminole County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Lima is the co-chair of Project Opioid. And as he often says, this whole issue is not about making bad people good. It's about making sick people well. And so those that are addicted to the drugs, we don't want to run through the criminal justice system. We want to get them help. I know our new state attorney here feels the same way. And so we're going to be working for those folks to get them into treatment. But for those folks that don't live in Bithlo, that come into this community and deal this poison, they're going to have to find Jesus in jail, because there's no longer going to be acceptable for them to operate out here.
You know, unfortunately, part of what I'm hearing is the more things change, the more they stay the same. You're talking about, you know, working with law enforcement to address the street level crime in this. I remember the crack days in the 80s growing up in Philadelphia. I remember the meth days, walking into a 7-Eleven and watching the cooks buy the ingredients over the counter. Are you concerned about what comes after fentanyl?
Yeah, I mean, we already see some drugs that are not even scheduled right now. In fact, the legislature will take up some of these other drugs that are being put into the drug supply. Literally, you know, tranquilizers used by veterinarians are being put into the drug supply that Narcan, naloxone does not impact, and literally will eat your body away. And I think for me, that's one of the most alarming things to see, is a person has to take a drug that literally will eat their body away to feel okay. And so I can't overstate the importance of not only having naloxone readily available, which is keeping people alive, but the medically assisted treatment and the psychiatric services and the licensed mental health counseling and the social work, which is then providing an opportunity for people to live. So we're keeping people alive by bringing back as many people as we can, as often as we can when they overdose, but we're really setting up a system of care that allows people to live. And so I'm so proud of Shannon, because she's living.
Shannon Gilliam is a Winter Park native in recovery. Timothy McKinney is the CEO of United Global Outreach. There's more ahead on Engage. We'll attend an event in Sanford that shines a light on the human trafficking that takes place right under our noses. All of our shows are available on demand at cfpublic.org. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, we'll meet an Ormond Beach entrepreneur who sees a future where people pair soda with their meals the same way they do with wine.
I want my own taste. I want my palate to experience this today or that tomorrow. Or if I'm having, you know, a pizza, I want this particular combination with it. Or if I'm having a salad, I want this with it.
ZodaWave CEO John Curlin joins Engage to talk about the sweet and the bubbly. But first, about 36 people gathered at the Seminole County Sheriff's Office in Sanford on a cool sunny Saturday morning. Multiple nonprofits representing anti-trafficking groups and abuse survivor organizations had tables set up with informational pamphlets. Olivia Littleton is a co-chair of the Central Florida Human Trafficking Task Force and a team supervisor with One More Child, a Christian-based 501c3 that provides a myriad of services for vulnerable children and struggling families. In addition to providing support for children in foster care, single parents, and families in need, One More Child works with survivors of human trafficking with both emotional care and material support. They also work with law enforcement agencies to bring awareness to trafficking, which Littleton explained was the purpose of that day's event.
The Red Sand Project was first created in 2014 by artist and activist Molly Goshman. It was created to increase public awareness and engagement of the vulnerabilities that can lead to human trafficking. The first Red Sand Project took place in Miami, where the cracks of sidewalks were filled in and around the Art Basel Miami Beach Pavilion with red sand. The approach is symbolic, with the grains of sand representing forgotten individuals who fall through the cracks, whether the cracks be of our social, economic, and political systems, or those of our personal consciousness.
One of the people those grains of sand represent is Stacy Ham. She's a survivor of human trafficking, and she works with One More Child, sharing her experience. Stacy uses her story to educate others about the dangers and abuse human trafficking leads to.
I was born into a third generational cycle of familial sex trafficking. I began being exploited and sold for sex at just the young age of 2. While being exploited, my siblings and I would often be found sleeping at parks or wandering around downtown trying to escape the abuse that we were enduring in our home. It took over 8 times being brought back to our home by police, who did not allow my mother to speak, but allowed our traffickers to speak as to why we were missing from the home. 19 hospitalizations, the murder attempt of my brother, my hips and my legs being broken, that we were finally removed from our home. Most of the time when I get to this part of my story, I share that I entered the foster care system and was adopted. And most of the times I keep hearing, that's amazing that you were rescued and that you were given a new life. Unfortunately, with my story, my adoptive home did not end the abuse. My adoptive home actually continued the abuse and the sexual exploitation. And what made it even harder is my dad was very well known in the community and was the pastor of our large church. I grew up going to church, seeing and hearing that we are to love one another and that we are to be the hands and feet. But for me, it was very confusing and twisted being in a home that I was told to be silent. We do not talk about the abuse and we do not talk about what happened. That was very twisted as a young child that came from being sexually exploited. Growing up then in this abusive home continuously, I then had a lot of vulnerabilities that led me to become more susceptible to being pulled back into a life of trafficking. I didn't have anywhere to turn as a young adult, and so I immediately made friends with a family that seemed like they were family to me. They showered me with gifts, attention, and love, and then ultimately turned into transactional. I was forced to produce content, and then when trying to leave, I was facing threats of where would I live, where would I work, and what would I do. 2 years later, I met an amazing friend through college while pursuing my degree of social work, and she encouraged me to leave the situation that I was in, and I can tell you that was like the start of what changed my life.
Human trafficking is depicted in the media as a part of an international crime syndicate. Think shipping containers full of people crossing the Pacific in The Wire, or young American women getting kidnapped by Albanian gangs and taken. Seminole County Undersheriff Ron Hopper noted that this Hollywood version is highly inaccurate.
This happens in all communities, and it's not just service, it's not just forced labor, it's sextortion. It runs the gamut of different criminal activity. It's anything forced, right? And it could be any age. And so it's easy to hide in plain sight, essentially.
Olivia Littleton agreed with Undersheriff Hopper and noted that part of her job is dispelling myths surrounding human trafficking.
So there's a misconception that human trafficking always involves transportation and kidnapping. But many people don't recognize that kidnapping is less than 1% of the human trafficking cases that we see. Instead, it's typically familial trafficking, so individuals who exploit members of their family. We also see Romeo traffickers or Romeo pimps who pretend to be a significant other of a victim and then exploit them through that close bond and grooming relationship that they build. So we're not really seeing stuff like the Taken movie. Instead, we're seeing victims that are still showing up for school and going to work, but they're being exploited by people who are close to them.
Hopper said subtle changes in behavior and appearance could be a clue that someone is a victim of trafficking.
People that seem to be controlled by someone or something, a change in hygiene, a change in dress and demeanor. Those subtle changes, when you take them all together, people get hunches, right? And so if you just see one or two of those, maybe it's nothing. But there's several that stand out in many of these victims, and people still kind of, they don't want to do anything because they feel they don't know what to do. And that's why we say, if you see something and you say something, we will absolutely do something. And again, if it turns out to be nothing, okay, so be it. That's what we get paid to do. That's our job.
One of the shocking statements Stacey Hamm made while addressing the gathering was that despite the numerous hospitalizations, visits from family services, and attention from teachers, nobody picked up on the fact that she was being abused as a child. I had the chance to speak directly with Stacey and asked her about these missed opportunities while interacting with these points of contact.
So I had 19 hospitalizations by the time I was just 3. And obviously because I had so many types of abuse, and rape situations. That's why I was always encountering the healthcare system. About 86% of those being exploited and trafficked will use the healthcare system at some point or another. So I'm really big on our service providers, healthcare, law enforcement being trauma-informed trained, because there were several times that we were missed in that care. My mother was not allowed to speak. Our trafficker did the speaking for her. So we were coming in for broken bones or bruises or malnourishment. It was always, we don't know what happened, that, you know, kids will be kids. And so she wasn't allowed. So those were all missed opportunities. And so growing up, seeing that, that made me then kind of feel a little bit resistant to anybody that then could ask. I know for me what did, another time that didn't help is I did have a suicide attempt at 19 due to I didn't know how to handle all the trauma that I was remembering. And so when I went in to see somebody for support, it was just, oh, well, just don't do it again. Use the hotline number if you need anything. And I had shared, hey, I remember what happened to me as a young child. I had a violent rape. And it was just, well, we think you're okay, so you can go ahead and go. And so that right there was another missed opportunity because I'm sharing about childhood abuse, which is, you know, is a crime. I mean, all abuse is a crime, but specifically as a minor. And so, and to see that ignored, that then made me hesitant to, well, how am I going to ever open up to people if there's been if things have been missed that have been so visible? Like, I wasn't wearing clean clothes. I was exceptionally malnourished, underweight. I had visible black eyes, bruises all over me. And to me, that was some big things that were being missed. Some of the other things was school absences. You got to ask yourself, why is there so many kids that are missing school? But, and why are we penalizing a six-year-old for not being able to get to school? And so that's another big red flag, is are we meeting with those parents and caregivers to see what's kind of going on? And so really what did help me come forward was having consistent people that weren't asking for the what happened in my past, but more like, where are you at now? What kind of job can we help you get? I had a couple great mentors, and it was, what's your housing look like? And I knew it wasn't transactional. So after kind of creating some really healthy relationships to where I wasn't having to give anything through force, fraud, or coercion, but really I could give how I felt in an appropriate friendship and relationship. That's where I started to feel like, oh, I think I want to talk about what I went through.
How old were you when you started to come to this realization that, you know, human relationships didn't have to be transactional?
It was not until I was 26. I had, for the first 26 years of my life, I had been told that I whatever an adult tells me to do, you do it. You don't ask questions. Anybody that has an authority title has the right and the ownership over you. My trafficker as a young adult, she actually was the store manager of where I used to work for retail. And so that was very innocent how that started. I was looking for housing. She asked me to come move in with her daughter. And when moving in, I thought, this was great, because what retail store manager is going to exploit you? And so that to me was just the shock of how easily you can become susceptible. And so for me, when leaving that situation, 3 years later, I was doing my undergrad for social work, and I was assigned a mentor. And I was like, why am I being given a mentor? This is crazy. Well, it's because the intensity that you experience as a social worker. They wanted you to feel like you could have somebody to talk to about how are you handling the hours, but also social work is not an easy field. And so it was through that mentor. She would meet with me every single week, and she started just kind of help me reflect on what does healthy relationships with healthy boundaries and consent look like, and then also what does a healthy surrounding family look like. And so that was the ultimate game changer, was getting just to see, having her walk alongside me for an entire year.
One More Child works hand in hand with law enforcement agencies to rescue survivors of trafficking and apprehend the criminals that propagate this trafficking, to help transition the survivors into real life, and to help them through any legal challenges they may be facing. Stacey Hamm explains.
Sometimes we are participating and offering insight when it comes to their operations and stings, but we're able to say, hey, this might look like prostitution or voluntary, but what we're seeing is this could be a cycle of being human, of being trafficked. And so we're able to give that insight, especially from a survivor's perspective. That's been the most beneficial, is to say this doesn't look like it's fully their choice. Who brought them here, you know, and why are they in this situation? And so we're able to support in that process. If we ever have any survivors going through trial or are going through, if they have charges themselves, we're working with them, helping them get their charges expunged. We don't personally get the charges expunged, but we're working with the appropriate people that are helping survivors in that. Those that are working on victim impact statements. And so they're going there and we're helping them write those. Or if they are also facing other charges, we're there the entire time.
Social media usage provides a convenient portal for traffickers to reach potential victims. One of the nonprofit vendors provided a chart of specific platforms that parents should watch out for and how they ensnare children. The list included the top players in the industry: TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter X, and about 20 others. Olivia Littleton explains.
So the majority of new trafficking cases, especially among teen and young adults, is we're seeing that they're meeting their traffickers online through social media. So it's no longer meeting, you know, a stranger in a parking lot or someone that you don't know that's kidnapping you and trafficking you. But instead, it's a teenager that never even has to leave their home to meet traffickers online.
The event concluded with the pouring of red sand into the cracks in the sidewalk in front of the sheriff's office.
Okay, thank you. All right, everyone, please grab some red sand and go ahead and start filling in the cracks all around the building. Thank you.
Dozens of small white plastic bags containing red sand were neatly lined up on a folding table. One by one, the participants took the baggies and carefully poured the contents into the concrete, symbolically filling the cracks that had been left open in the past. And you can attend the next Red Sand Project event, January 25th at the City of Kissimmee Civic Center, hosted by the Central Florida Human Trafficking Task Force. Coming up, dirty sodas are causing a stir in Ormond Beach. We'll get a taste of what the new family-owned shop has to offer from its founder. And we want to hear from you. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about or what you're glad you heard. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org, or you can send us a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. In the menu, select Send Us a Talkback, record your question or feedback, then hit Send. You're listening to Engage. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. When John Curlin received a phone call from his daughter at a drive-thru, ideas started fizzing. When she described the taste of a custom-made gourmet soda, it sounded like a flavor he needed to bring to Central Florida. Curlin recently opened Soda Waves in Ormond Beach, where customers can create their drink of choice. The so-called dirty sodas are mixed and infused with flavors, and they've exploded recently as the drink of choice in the Hulu reality show The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. Shops selling the custom non-alcoholic cocktails have been popular for years in states like Utah, but it's a new concept in Central Florida. John Curlin spoke with Engage host Sharon Stone last week. She began their discussion by asking Curlin to describe how Soda Waves came to be.
So about 5 years ago, our oldest daughter, who lives in Idaho, was on the phone with her. It was late Georgia time. And she said, Dad, hang on, I'm going through a drive-thru. I said, okay, that's cool. She said, be just a minute. I said, okay. I said, it was probably 30 seconds, maybe 45, right? And she came back on and she said, okay, I'm ready. And then I hear this, this is so good. I thought, what'd you get? She said, a flavored soda. So what's a flavored soda? And all I remember that it was a Mountain Dew-based drink. And she said, Dad, this is so good. So fast forward 5 years, our family started digging into this, discovered what you may or may not know about others in the market, really big out west. And so when we moved back to Florida, I said, you know what? There's nothing here in Ormond Beach or surrounding areas that offer this. And so we opened Soda Waves November 18th of last year.
What is a gourmet soda? Like you mentioned, there is a following for it in Midwest, West Coast area.
Right. So a gourmet soda is really taking a soda base of your choice, primarily Coke base. So think Coke, Coke Zero, Dr. Pepper, Pepsi base, Pepsi, right? The off brands, Mug Root Beer, Ginger Ale, on the lighter side, 7-Up Sprite. So it's all the bases, and we offer both through Coke, Pepsi, and then Keurig Dr. Pepper. So that's the Sunkist line, et cetera. And it's taking the bases and then it's adding clean flavoring to the soda base. So really simple example is if you want a vanilla Coke, right? You would have a Coke and you would add a flavoring to it, mix it in. You may want to add some cream, whether it's coconut cream or vanilla cream. And then you have that as a gourmet soda. So it's much different than the canned drink that the manufacturers are trying to put out there. So cherry or vanilla or orange or something like that.
John, what is your favorite gourmet soda that you can concoct?
Yeah, it's called Windsurfer, and it is a 7-Up base, which is a light base. It has pomegranate and grapefruit. And then the real kick is that we add a wedge of fresh lime to that. And so when you mix it, the alchemy with the acid from the lime and the flavorings along with the base, it is such a refreshing, delicious soda. So that's my favorite.
What has the reaction been in the Ormond Beach community to people walk in to your place?
You know, Sharon, I would say this. God has been very good to us. We have been blessed beyond measure. And when we opened the first day, we were really shocked and surprised at how the community came out. And so ever since then, we've established, I would say, a pretty solid following in Ormond Beach, but we've also gone north. So think about Palm Coast. We've gone and have customers coming as far south as Edgewater and beyond. We've got people coming from DeBary and DeLand and Deltona. It's been wonderful to see, but unbelievable at the same time. We have well over 1,000 customers now in this short period of time. We've probably got probably a low 70% loyalty base, meaning return customers sometimes daily, certainly at least 3 or 4 times a week. We have new customers signing up every day. It's just been, it's been great. I don't know any other way to say it. It's just been fantastic.
How many possibilities of soda could I come up with at your place?
Oh, endless amounts, right? So one of the features we have is a create your own. So with the bases that we have, dark and light. So I'll walk you through it real quick. So 2 paths. One is create your own, where you pick a size cup, you pick a base soda, and you pick any add-ins. So once you pick your size, 44, 32, 24, 16, or 12, then you would pick your soda, dark or light base. Then you would add any flavors that you wish, any creams, purees, or fruits. So you get to be your own mad scientist. On the other side, we have 24 signature drinks, 12 dark base, again, Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, Bright Root Beer, et cetera. And then 12 on the light side. So 7-Up, Sprite, Ginger Ale, Mountain Dew, et cetera there. And so what we found is, and the word endless, I'll put it in quotes, because there is an end at some point, right? But clearly hundreds and hundreds of combinations. And we have people coming in every day who are creating their own. And so we've seen a shift from what originally started out as the signature drinks, kind of like what was, to now people get it. I want my own taste. I want my palate to experience this today or that tomorrow. Or if I'm having, you know, a pizza, I want this particular combination with it. Or if I'm having a salad, I want this with it. It's just crazy.
What would you say to people who are only familiar with the idea of a gourmet soda from the reality show Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, where they go and that's their hangout spot?
Yeah. So, you know, we're very aware of our competition. And competition is a great thing, right? That's why there's a Wendy's and a McDonald's and a Burger King on every corner. And then you got a Chick-fil-A, right? So we welcome that. One of the things that others in the market, so Sodalicious and Fixology and Swig and a number of others out there have done, is they've created this environment for people to be able to enjoy something in the crazy world in which we live today. And so that show has exacerbated what, quote unquote, the dirty soda. And years ago, there was a lawsuit between two founding companies of this genre, if you will. They settled in court, you know, terms weren't disclosed, but that whole thing has come about. And so the show itself, I think, has helped to promote it. Certainly TikTok and social media has promoted that as well. And while, yes, that's had some impact positively for us when we opened, the show was kind of coming through. So, you know, we had people coming in, hey, I saw this on TikTok, or hey, I saw that there. At the end of the day, that, I would say, initial excitement has really dissipated because reality has set in and folks are now seeing, hey, we can do this ourselves. We don't need TikTok. We don't need this. We get to do our own thing. So it's helped, but it's changed a little bit too.
John Curlin owns Soda Waves, the custom gourmet soda shop in Ormond Beach. Yeah,
And that's all for today's edition of Engage. We are back on Thursday at 3. I'm Richard Copeland. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News. Go, go, work.